and welcome to the fourth edition of the Enduro World Series podcast. My name is Rick McLaughlin, and it's been yet another hectic week at the home of the world's best mountain bike race series. So we've a bit to get through. Helping me, as always, like a faded magician's assistant, is none other than Rory Cunningham, a man who's been there and raced pretty much everything and has actually done a fair bit of winning along the way too. Rory, how are you and what have you been up to this week?
I'm very well, Rick. It's been an interesting week here in Scotland. We've had quite a lot of snow, so not much riding, not much golf. The home gym's been getting quite a lot of abuse though, so Operation 85 Kegs is going well.
Rory, we should point out at this stage, is on a post-racing odyssey to get himself to 85 kilograms, which he continually refers to as getting to Project 85 Kegs, but it took a turn for the worse and was rapidly spiralling towards Project 90 Kegs, wasn't it?
It was, and I had a bit of a realisation on the week when I was riding the e-bike. I was out in the snow and my battery went flat at around 600 metres, and it was pretty cold, and I was thinking to myself, you know, it's the cold, it's be like my iPhone battery, as soon as you get outdoors it just drops off a cliff. And then I had the realisation that battery consumption's probably got a lot to do with power to weight, and Operation 85 Kegs was maybe a bit counterintuitive to what I was actually trying to achieve in my job. I convinced myself that it doesn't really matter because I'll be strong enough to carry loads of spare batteries anyway, so I'll just crack on.
I really want you to get to that sort of early 90s TV World's Strongest Man sort of weight where, like, you could be pulling a jumbo jet down Edinburgh Airport's runway for charity. And that's the sort of size I want you to get to with them big, like, big belts and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, I've got the hair, so, I mean, they just need the belt.
Yeah, just for regular listeners, a hair update. He still hasn't cut it. It's still looking good now. Obviously, we don't want to start this on a downer, but no one wants to cancel a trip to Whistler. But amid the COVID global pandemic, it's something that the EWS has decided to do along with our partners at Crankworx. There are still obviously a lot of uncertainties regarding international travel. Rory, tell us about what these changes mean to the dates. We effectively now have two big blocks of racing in 2021, don't we?
We do. It kind of splits the calendar right down the middle. I mean, Whistler was the only kind of anomaly that was outside of Europe. So we have the first lot in June, July. So Val d'Isère and La Twelve with EWS, and obviously kicking things off with Valberg EWSE. And the riders get almost 2 months off before we go back to Loudonville, Crans Montana, and then back to the Med for Pietra and Finale, and then the Tweed Valley to finish things out. So yeah, it's quite interesting. We see this a lot in other sports, you know, Formula One, MotoGP, they all have the mid-season break, as they call it. So I think it'll be quite interesting. It'll be intriguing to see who comes back from that break refreshed and firing on all cylinders, and who maybe slacks off a little bit and doesn't carry the momentum through. So, it's another twist in the road, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a lot of double headers in there as well, a lot of double events. So I'm sure that second block, especially, like, it's wall to wall racing all the way through September. As I said, nobody wants to cancel a trip to Whistler, and it's such an amazing place for mountain biking. We'll be back as soon as we can be back, that's for certain. What is it about that place, in your estimations, that makes it so special?
It's difficult to put your finger on kind of one thing. You know, there's so many trails, everybody's there. You know, obviously we've got a lot of friends within the industry, and you can kind of go riding on the lift till 8 o'clock at night. There's lots of good restaurants, lots of good bars. The weather's usually good in August if the mountains behind Whistler aren't on fire. And I think it's just like Finale, it's just a regular kind of part of the calendar that you get used to a little bit. And I think when you get used to it, I don't know, it kind of holds a pretty special place in your heart, if without sounding too romantic. But look, it's one of my favourite places to visit, and to anybody listening, obviously maybe now's not the time to suggest international travel, but in the future, if you can get yourself there, you have to experience it. As a mountain biker, you have to experience it at least once.
You've got to go, haven't you? Definitely. We're going back, that's a certainty. Now, Finale is a regular EWSE now, no Trophy of Nations there. could well be an absolutely revolutionary EWSE course, couldn't it?
It could indeed. Obviously, we're a little way off the course being released and the full plan going ahead, but I've heard some pretty big numbers being thrown about.
I love this, actually. I think this is fascinating. This is typical Finale in a lot of ways, of just the like, it reflects how much those guys just throw themselves into everything, and there's a sort of a Finale filter you apply to everything, and it's, you know, like, it's developed itself as this ultimate sort of mecca for European mountain bikers, and now it's gone e-bikes, right, how can we do that bigger, better, racing, let's do racing, let's make the biggest, you know, and they love it, and I think that comes over in everything those guys do. Trophy of Nations, you know, it'll be back as well at some stage, but obviously with the team component, etc., we just kind of thought that let's get more racing on the calendar, and that'll be the last EWSE of the year before we head to the Tweed Valley as well. So all to play for there. Looking forward to that one.
Yeah, I think the racing Finale could be pretty special, to be honest. You know, we're not to let the carry the bag, but you know, we're looking at a 2-day EWSE. I'd estimate upwards of 6,000 meters to descend in over 2 days, which is just huge. And if, you know, if we think about the trail network they have there, you know, every year they seem to be able to put out a course that nobody's ever done before. So the trail network's vast. Those guys know what they're doing. You know, you've got the weather, the beach, the gelato, the coffee.
Who was it? I think when we were there last year. I think it might have been you. I was sort of comparing it. This comparison came to my head, but going to Finale with a mountain bike to me always feels a bit like a weekend away to London. In that, like, you love it, your mind's blown, but then you come away from it sort of thinking that you've not really scratched the surface and you don't really know the place any better. There's always, like, the team there are so good at opening up another hill that we've never been to, or like another trail network that you've never been on, and like, you just constantly ride stuff that you haven't ridden before, and if you do ride stuff that you recognise, it's all of a sudden like, oh yeah, no, I've done this before.
Yeah, you always find yourself riding down a trail not knowing exactly where you are, going, oh no, I do recognise this, but it's kind of a mystery how you got there.
It's generally a mystery how I get to anything on a mountain bike, to be honest.
Yeah, well, you know, you drank at Finale, it wouldn't be surprising.
Yeah, it's good for a party as well, Finale, right? So we've gained the Specialized EWSE and the EWS Crans Montana so far. Sadly, we've lost Whistler. It's just another example, I think, of global sport having to be pretty fluid in the face of the pandemic. And hopefully we can eventually get back to living in a world where calendar change has become a thing of the past. Now, we've mentioned those two blocks. If you want to get a chance, to get onto the start line in 2021, then you only have a couple of days really to wait to get a hold of those entries when they go on public release on the 22nd of February. Get online at EnduroWorldSeries.com, work out which EWS or EWSE race is right for you. With a bit of luck, we'll be seeing you on the stages later in the summer. Right, now it's only taken us 4 episodes, but finally we've got some racing to talk about, which is very, very exciting. And that came in the form of the first EWS qualifier of the year in Falls Creek, down under, the Victorian Gravity Enduro Series, always hotly contested. It has to be said though, as Rory's alluded to, we're recording this in basically sort of like an ice sort of tomb at the minute. Relatively speaking, so to see blue skies, short sleeve shots, pretty sickening, but great to see some racing taking place. Conor Fearon, long time Kona Factory team rider, took the win there. Rachel Hoare as well won the pro women's race. I think Ben McElvoy put a couple of seconds into Conor on Fall Creek's Big Fella stage, quite a famous trail down there. But other than that, it was pretty much one-way traffic. Rory Fearon's a class act, isn't he?
He is indeed. Very, very unique rider. One of the few, him and Sam, obviously the kind of two notable riders that still ride flat pedals. And Conor, you know, still cutting it in at the top of both downhill and enduro. So, very unique rider. I'd say arguably one of the best best riders on the planet going around the corner. You know, and he's had some standout, you know, standout results over the years within enduro and downhill. I think if, you know, a couple of years ago was he second or third at Derby, and he's graced the World Cup podium more than once. And yeah, I'd be interested. I don't know if he's got plans to do more EWS in 2021, but it would be really intriguing to see. Not to be critical, but it would be interesting to see how he coped with like the kind of the meat of the season in Europe, you know, venues that are fresh to him and kind of outside the Oceania region. I'd be really intrigued to see how he'd go, you know, against all the top guys, you know, Jesse, Sam, Martin.
To be honest, I think he's, if there's anybody who wasn't going to be fazed, given his experience with racing World Cups in a European quote-unquote summer, you know, he's probably going to be one of those crossover pros who could well do it. Yeah, he's one of those. He's one of those riders, isn't he? Like, he rides a bike the way you think you ride it in your head. Do you know what I mean? His cornering speed is just unbelievable. He's been on that Kona team for some amount of time now as well. The bikes obviously suit him. Mathieu Dupel, the team manager, and him are very close.
Yeah, they're fond of Subarus as well, I think.
Ah, well, look, all the good guys are.
See what you're fanboying them.
We've had a couple of more team announcements in the form of Rocky Mountain Raceface reconfirming probably the strongest free rider lineup in the sport. Jesse Melamed, Remy Govan, Andrian Lamphy and Ado. The team setup looks pretty much unchanged. They've got a shiny new team launch video. That's about as strong as team lineups get, isn't it?
It is almost effectively Team Canada, if you were to call it that. But I mean, look, Jesse was the form rider last year. If 2020 was a title, he would have won it. So you know, he must be coming into this season confident. You know, Remy, he's always there or thereabouts. I believe he's been kind of top 10 overall two or three times in ALN. You know, she's been on the podium a couple of times, and I guess still searching for that elusive first win. But you feel like with progression, she's been shown, and I saw a couple of videos of her on Instagram last week sending an enormous drop. So, you know, it's good to see her pushing things, and, you know, I think only a matter of time before she graces that top step.
That that drop you mentioned is in that team launch video, and she absolutely nails it in there. Really, we recommend that team launch video just for some of the line choices all three of them take on those trails. I'm guessing it's Squamish. I think they all live sort of local to that trail network. Yeah, I don't think team lineups get much stronger. Bit of a funny 2020, I guess, with Jesse with those couple of wins. Obviously, super happy for him. Remy didn't really have the year I think he would have wanted, but quite a tricky one, you know, like only three races. Quite a big flyaway, you know, trip for him. He's one of those riders that we regularly see as well. Like, he's a championship rider, isn't he? Like, he really comes into form as the year goes on. ALN, she had that big, horrible crash in Zermatt, actually. Where she was on the front wheel for what looked like a mile and a half before she eventually went over the front of it. And so that sort of crocked her a wee bit in terms of pace. Oh. But, I mean, yeah, that is just about as strong a lineup as I think the Enduro World Series could muster.
Yeah, definitely. And the cool thing is they all seem to, you know, outside a race and at race, and they all seem to be a pretty close kind of knit unit. You know, they're almost like a little family, which is, you know, if you're traveling the world and you're having to put up with people for months at a time, you kind of need that friendship and that group kind of camaraderie, and they certainly seem to have that and work really strong as a unit.
This is one of those things that I've always actually wondered about being a pro. Like, how important is getting on with your teammates? Because, you know, I've been to different team houses to interview, you know, individual riders in the past, and the mood isn't always good inside them. Do you know what I mean? If people don't get on, if there's any sort of cracks in a relationship, getting beaten by somebody at a bike race is a pretty surefire way to make them even bigger, isn't it?
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, I think it can I think it's really important. I think with the amount of time you're on the road, the time you spend with people, with team and staff and stuff, you know, the amount of kind of trust you have to have as a rider, that when you get to the pits, if the mechanic's doing your bike, the trust level you've got to have to jump on that thing and, you know, wring its neck and know that it's exactly as it should be. There's definitely an element of required cohesion within the team. I think for the most part, mountain biking doesn't really have that kind of clash of egos. You know, the bigger riders tend to be on separate teams. But quite often, you know, if you have a team that signs riders for kind of 2-3 years and the riders, like, they're kind of bowlers, so they really kind of start getting some results really quickly, you can have riders kind of knocking heads a bit. And, you know, I guess I've been pretty close to it for a number of years and could probably have some examples, but I think the media do a good job of kind of sugarcoating it and, you know, making it out like they all get on. But look, if you're in a team and you've got a teammate and they're beating you and you feel like you should be beating them, it's not a good place to be in.
Just for the record, I never sugarcoated anything about your career.
No, you should have, though.
What would you rather have? Would you rather have a teammate that you get on really well with or a mechanic that you get really on well with? What's more important? Which relationship?
Well, I'm going to sound selfish here, but I'm going to say mechanic.
Yeah.
Because I think, although you're in a team, it's not a team sport, right? As in, I mean, it's a team overall, but if you're a racer, like, I was never thinking I'm going to go for the team overall here. I was thinking I'm here for me. And that's the mentality you have to have. Like, you know, you're purely in it for yourself. And I look back and think, man, I was so selfish and I was, you know, I mean, so focused on my own stuff. But when you're in it, it's difficult not to see it that way. I think if you have a good relationship with your mechanic, it's somebody who's, if your performance is good and their performance is good, it kind of works in harmony and the result's good. Whereas if your teammate is riding well and they ride good and you ride good, you could still get beaten by them. So, yeah. You know, you look at riders on the circuit, you know, you look at, I mean, for me personally, like, you know, you look at the relationship that, like, I had an amazing relationship with my mechanic Tyler when I was on Trek, and you look at Mark Morrison and Martin Mays, you look at Sam Hill and JC, you know, downhill, like, somebody really close to me, Troy and his mechanic Aaron, you know, that they work really well together, and I think that's super important. Obviously getting on with your teammates is important, but you know, if you've got two teammates that are really, really good friends and your bikes have fallen to bits, then it's not really going to work either.
Well, it's actually funny you mention that. It's actually made me remember really a point we just talked about, Conor Fearon. I was there at the Leagang World Cup when Gwyn won without a chain.
The one from God.
The chain flew off, and it was actually Conor Fearon that was in the hot seat.
Mm.
And I'd, like, everybody obviously lost their minds when Gwyn won without a chain. I turned and I was in. My professional career of covering mountain bike racing, I have never seen a face like Conor Fearon's, and I felt so bad for him because that was it. Do you know what I mean? That was World Cup one. You know, chains off, that's it, job done. And turned out Aaron Gwyn had other ideas, but let's talk about some really, we were talking about being selfish, let's talk about some big news for the pair of us. We've got new bikes. Well, I mean, I do, you don't.
Yeah, I mean, your bike showed up, mine hasn't. They're both beautiful lavender in colour. It's exactly what I wanted. And, yeah, looking forward to, well, whenever mine gets here, I'm looking forward to assembling it and riding it.
We are.
Just come along and sabotage yours.
We are, of course, talking about the Santa Cruz Bullet. We've each got one. Mine's arrived. Thanks to COVID travel. I don't actually know what's worse, not having a new bike or knowing that you do have a new bike but not being able to travel to collect it. It's arrived
tomorrow and take photos send it to you just to make you a little bit more jealous.
Yeah, it's perilously close to Rory. Fortunately, it's an XL though, so he won't be able to ride it.
I'll just check the stem on backwards, it'll be fine.
Yeah, so these are going to be our bikes for the season. We're going to be on Santa Cruz Megatars and Bullets. I've been on a Megatar for, what's this, 2 or 3 years now. Know the bike really well, love it. I mean, I'm no pro rider, but I've ridden enough bad bikes to know a good one when I'm sat on it, and that is a great bike. But it's the Bullet that I think we're both rightly excited for, because as we've talked about on this podcast before, the trend for long travel and aggression is really gathering pace, particularly in e-bikes. Mixed wheel size, 170mm of travel, Shimano EP8 drive unit. It's going to be an absolute beast of a machine, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't wait, to be honest. I think, you know, last year the Heckler served us well, and you know, obviously ended up putting mine to Mullet in the end, but to kind of ride a, you know, like you say, 170mm travel, kind of longer, slacker, exactly what we spoke about with the super enduro kind of bikes, but in an e-bike, not to mention the new Shimano EP8 motor with, you know, more power and a bigger battery, so we can go up more hills, which I'll need weighing about 10 kilos more than I did last year. But yeah, I mean, can't wait.
I genuinely hope that yours turns up. I do hope it turns up. I kind of feel that we should do a bit of a special podcast or some video stuff, or do a bit of a deep dive on our bikes when they arrive and sort of talk a bit about how we're setting them up and stuff. You probably more than me, because you actually know what you're doing. I just wave a shock pump at it until it looks about right. But yeah, let's do that, right? Let's revisit that once I can actually physically go and claim mine and yours arrives. Incidentally, if you are in Midlands Airport and you see somebody commuting about on a lavender Santa Cruz, please let Rory know via the usual channels. Right, let's talk more team stuff. Lapierre Zip Collective have announced a new young gun added to their roster, Lisandro Bertini. He's under 21, Corsican. Do you know what? Like, I'm just going to go out on a limb and say he's going to be fast, because that's a fast sounding name. Do you know what I mean? Lisandro Bertini, that is like, that's a speedy name. They've also added Renfal Controls and WTB as a saddle partner. Now, I mean, they're on the face of it pretty small addition, seemingly, to what's a fantastic looking race machine. Those factory Lapierres are great looking bikes. But I just thought I'd ask you, Roy, about how important is it to be sat in the right place on a bike in top flight enduro racing? You're on the things all day, aren't you? Like, it can be 50k days. We've talked about 6,000 vertical meters in some of the e-bike races potentially, like in the next couple of years. You've got to have things right, haven't you?
Yeah, you've got to be comfortable. I mean, you know, anybody knows that sitting in an office chair for 6-7 hours a day can get pretty uncomfortable when you've got to pedal a bike round and you're sitting on something that's probably about 1/10 the size of that. It needs to be right, and it needs to be comfortable. So yeah, I mean, pretty minor changes as far as you know, Renfal for, I guess, kind of handlebar stem and maybe grip, and then WTB for saddles. But these are things that, although minor, these are things that, you know, now kind of 4 or 5 months out of the, you know, ahead of the season, they'll be testing different things and trying different saddles, try different bends, rises on the bars, widths, and maybe stem lengths. So yeah, I mean, it's you know, two very well established companies, and I'm sure they've got enough scope to get it exactly how they want it. But yeah, better to do that now in February than be rushing around doing it at the races.
I know. I used to actually work with Ian Collins from Renfal back in my magazine days. We were both journalists on Mountain Biking UK magazine, and I know that he's 100% the right guy in that to be in that company doing what they do, and that they have a very obviously motorsport sort of approach to things, from their multiple motorbike world championship titles. So I'd imagine that stuff is all going to be, I mean, that's a dream for a race company to work with, you know, a brand that has that kind of reputation already. But there is, I mean, we know Nico Vuglio, big part of the Lapierre setup. We saw him dicing it out in the EWSE last season. He, of course, left mountain biking to go rallying. And there is just that kind of motorsport attention to detail with stuff, you know. Like chatted with his mechanic Craig Miller in Pietra, and he was saying that all their tires, they pre-scrub them before they go on the race bikes, just to get bits of like grit and dirt into the rubber to make them even grippier, you know. The addition of this young gun into that setup, dream opportunity for that young rider to learn.
Yeah, I don't think there's many riders out there put as much attention to detail as Nico. You know, funny hearing about scrubbing tires before they set off. I mean, that's the level that guy's gone to over the years to get every inch performance out of his machines. And what an opportunity. Not just learning about the mechanical side of things but Nico, how many titles? Is it 10 downhill world titles? Few DBS races, and now an EWSC race, and you know, just learning. You know, the kid needs to go in and just be like a sponge. And not to mention Isabel, you know, I mean, like the success that she's had in the EWS as well. You know, if he goes in there and can learn from them, and you know, translate that into progressing in his own ride. And I mean, what an opportunity. And yeah, like you said, a fast name, so we'll keep an eye out for him this year.
I mean, Nico, there's so many examples of him and his, you know, his fanatical attention to detail that, as you say, contributed towards all those titles. But I talked to EMBN Steve Jones. He did a big bike check with him. He's a complete Vuglio fanboy, you know, big follower of his career, always has been. And he was saying that Nico was actually telling him that he was actually training to be the right weight to match the like torque delivery of the Bosch motor in that, or the Bosch power unit in that bike. So yeah, if this Andrew can keep his eyes open, he might learn a thing or two. Say again?
That's where I've gone wrong. I'm not matching my weight to the EPA motor. I need to get on the phone with Nico.
You'd be looking like a Chevrolet LS1 or something in there for you.
I need it two more.
a motor per wheel.
Yeah, just a motor per crank.
Were you a bit of a setup sweater when you were racing, or because you'd done it for so long, did you kind of just wave some Allen keys at it and were you good to go? They call it puzzling now, don't they?
I think it was probably somewhere in the middle, to be honest. I think once I got, it took a bit of time for me to get a setup that I liked, as in I was quite fussy about getting it to a point. And I had a few things in particular that I was really fussy about. But once I got, as long as they were okay, like main things I was fussy about was brakes was probably the biggest one. If I had brakes that faded or pumped up or weren't just like exactly how I wanted them, I used to throw my toys out the pram. Brake, suspension, tires, and then once I kind of got them as is, I mean, like suspension's kind of one of these things where if you get it to a point, you set and forget. I guess like tire pressures as well, kind of, you know, if it's a little bit wetter, you'll go a little bit softer, or if it's more dry, you'll go a bit harder or certain compounds. It was more the things that could fluctuate through the day. So, you know, if you had a big day with lots of descending, like your brakes could change quite a lot, and I really didn't like that. But I certainly wasn't one of the people that was constantly going to a race changing things. I think about enduro as well, like when it comes to setup, you have to be comfortable. But I found that if I did lots of testing on a track, what would happen is I'd get so used to the track, I'd start to ride faster. You know, because I was then riding on memory and not on kind of what was in front of me, you start riding faster. So then because you're going faster, you make the bike stiffer. So you put more air in the suspension. But then when you go to an EWS event, you only get to ride the track once. So when you actually race it, although you go really damn fast on the stage, if you had a whole day to race the stage, you'd probably find, you know, put a second or two a minute, I would say, on your actual race pace. So then your bike, if you'd based your bike setup on riding a track over and over and over, it would quite often be too stiff. So I'd always end up like getting my bike to a point where I was super happy with it, and I'd go to a race and be like, it feels really harsh, and then always go back to kind of what I knew. So I think that's something that certainly for me, I learned over time and kind of was like, right, I know I've got kind of base setup. And then it wasn't so much, you know, thinking about going and doing lap after lap after lap and getting a set in. It was more just, right, what's comfortable kind of throughout. And not quite as specific.
I think we're sort of, the final section we're going to talk about today is yet another absolutely fantastic Ask Us Anything from Instagram earlier in the week. But we are sort of now straying into one of those questions I think somebody's asked us. But what setup advice do you think you'd give someone? I think we're like looking at it through more amateur eyes like mine. My problem, I think, would be that my bike is obviously set up for my local trails in Scotland where I live. And if I got an entry and was lucky enough to get to go and race in, say, Pietra, which is completely different sort of style of riding and, you know, style of terrain, grip levels to what I have near my home. Should I go out and just see how my setup feels? Is there like go-to changes I should make? What do you reckon?
I think you've got to go out and adjust on the ground there. I think if you went out and you're riding new trails and a new setup that you've kind of guessed, you've got two new things that you're trying to learn, not one. I think a base setup, for the most part, should be fairly consistent most places. The biggest mistake I see amateurs kind of do is they set their bikes up in a car park. So they do their, you know, I mean, they sit on their bikes and you see them adjusting their air pressures and this and that. Even things like, you know, brake position, handlebar position, and they bounce around the car park and go, yeah, it feels great. And it's like you kind of feel like, you know, you should be setting that up for riding down a, you know, 20, 30 degree angle hill. You know, if you feel like your suspension's set up right in a car park, as soon as you go downhill, there's more weight through your hands, less weight through your feet. So then you see people riding with like their forks 60% into the travel because they've set it up for 20% on the flat.
Yeah.
And then suddenly when they're going downhill and they're braking, so they're effectively, when you pull the brakes on, you slow the bike down, and the way you slow yourself down is you brace and weight the bike. So it's like, yeah, I think that's the biggest thing, is like set your bike up on the trail based on like kind of feel and not in the car park. Yes, you can get a base kind of like, you know, if you're kind of about 30% sag on the rear for on the flat, I'd say it's pretty okay, and even less, maybe 10 in the front. But, you know, definitely base it on the characteristics of riding the trail, not bounce around the car park thinking it feels great.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? Because I can see, and to be honest, I've done it. You get to a race, you're pumped because you're at a race, you're excited about it, you want to get all the stuff ticked off, and you know, you want to get your bike set up, and you just do it there in the car park, and then you head out riding and the bike feels like a bag of spanners. Right, let us dive in to what is going to be, I'm sure, a very entertaining trip into Ask Us Anything. Right, let's have a look at what you guys have been asking us this week. Right, somebody's just asked us, Rave? Eli MTB. Ruri, Rave?
Can you do that? Can you do that at 2 meters social distance, Ray?
No. Yeah, raving's maybe something for the post-pandemic age. What does it take to compete in EWS? So that is from, wow, Yao, Okay, it doesn't matter who it's from. What does it take? What does it take to compete in the EWS? So, what do you think is the sort of what do you think is a differentiator between those top riders and everyone else?
Well, first of all, you need an entry.
Yep.
So, if you want to compete, you've got to get an entry.
February 22nd, get one of them. Seamless.
I mean, you need a kind of bit of everything. You need, you know, very good technical skills. You need very good level of fitness. You need the kind of the composure and the calmness to perform over and over. And I guess the instinct to or the kind of ability to or confidence to ride on kind of instinct. And just I think that the hardest thing about enduro is the commitment levels needed when you don't really know the trail that well. And that, like, I think I've said this before, but coming from downhill, that is the kind of the dark art that nobody talks about.
Yeah.
You know, to go flat out on your limit and not know what's around the corner, and it's something that I don't think you can learn it other than racing, and you know, anybody can go fast on the local trail, but when you've got to go fast on a trail you've ridden once and you've got to do that 6 times in a day,
that's where
the cream rises to the top. And you know, you see the same riders, you know, you're Sam Hills, Martin Mays, Richie Roos, Jesse Melamedes. That's where you see those guys. No matter where they are in the world, they're right up there, going like hell. So,
okay.
I mean, that's the. You need a bit of everything, but that's the most important piece.
Okay, Jimmy Ingram, 05, has got his money's worth, and he's asked us 2 or 3 very good questions. But I'm going to go with the last one. Music's effect on an athlete. You ever one for the big headphones staring out the pit? I can imagine you have a bit of Phil Collins on in the headphones.
I was never really one for music, to be honest. I quite like music. Like, I really like music in my own time, but I always find it was fired up enough.
Angry enough without Rage Against the Machine, basically, is what you're saying.
Yeah, pretty much. I feel like if I listened to Rage Against the Machine on the start line, I probably wouldn't make it past the first corner, so...
Five and a half foot of pure rage.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I mean, when I raced a few of the top riders, I think I can remember Keegan Wright riding kind of stage to stage with headphones, and a few other riders, maybe not at the cutting edge of the results, but they'd be riding around with like a speaker. And
what do you make of this? What do you make of the speaker thing? What's your take on that? Because I've seen it done casually at trail centres and stuff, and I have to say it's not for me, but I am getting very old and very grumpy.
No, I don't really. It doesn't really do it for me either, to be honest. I mean, why would you carry a speaker when you could carry food?
There we go. Okay. Next one is from Throttle by Cable. Future of the series in terms of broadcasting. I'll handle this. It's all right with you, Rory. We're entering into our second year with the Global Mountain Bike Network, GMBN, YouTube. We're looking to bring all of you guys as much content from what is looking like an extremely stacked race series. I think if there's anything left of me by the end of September, it'll probably just be a skeleton holding a microphone, looking into a camera. But
we'll do this last year then.
Yeah, similar. Less with less hair. We're always looking at ways to improve our coverage. We're always looking for sort of the next big thing. So there's a few ideas in the pipeline at the minute. So literally,
first of all, let's get a decent presenter.
Yeah, if we can get the money to do that, that would be it. We tried this new guy last year, but he was a disaster. When is it too old to ride in enduro? And that's from Mark EV _MTB. There's some guys who've crested 50 who've raced EWS amateur level and enjoyed it as much as anyone else did.
I think amateurs, we see riders, you know, in their 50s, no problem. And for the pros, I mean, how old's Sam? 36, maybe? That'd be a guess. I mean, Nico Vulios, he must be 40 and or older. And, you know, based on the speed he was going in Pietro on the e-bike, definitely wasn't showing his age. Interestingly, I don't know if how many people are aware of this, but EWSE and EWS actually shared the first kind of two stages. They were pretty much corner for corner, and Adrian Daly won the first stage, and Nico Vulio finished on the same second in the e-bike race.
I don't know
who went faster, and it wasn't a course that would rely on the motor a lot, but they were pretty much second for second on that stage. Someone might need to look into that, but it did happen.
That is absolutely remarkable. That's a serious stat you've just pulled out there. Right, I've now got one from Edward Story, who wants to know, do you think I will ever make it into the EWS? I think you will, Edward, yep. Let's see, what have we got? Rory, how do you, Mr. Wan L wants to know how to overcome the fear when tackling technical terrain, steep stuff. I guess that comes back to your last point about committing to the unknown.
I think it's about kind of developing as a rider as well. I think you've got to take steps and gradually begin to ride more technical terrain. If you go from riding flat, smooth trail centres and then you're cast into the EWS and faced with a steep, rocky chute, then it is going to be really intimidating. So I think it's a matter of building up, progress as a rider, try to ride more technical terrain. Just gradually build up and, go from there. I think most riders do a lot of their development and their technical training and develop as riders outside of racing. And racing can kind of be where you put it all on the line and show it. So I think it's just building your own time and figure it out.
Right, we're going to do one more, and I'm going to combine it because it's similar sort of a question. Savage Rider and Johnston Matthew 05. Savage Rider wants to know, is the EWS coming to India? And Johnston Matthew 05 wants to know, is the EWS coming to Northern Ireland? No plans for either, sadly, but I think they'd both be. We talked about our like dream venues we haven't been to yet. That'd be great to take it to India and Northern Ireland, wouldn't it?
And have an EWS in the Himalayas. I'm in.
Yeah, well, that'd be good. Right, there we go then. That's episode 4 in the books. Join us next week, of course, where we're going to be... I think we should do another Ask Us Anything. I think that was quite good. We got some good questions in there. So we'll put a call out for that probably the middle of next week. Thank you very much for listening, as ever. I'm predicting we're going to have a busy week ahead of us, Rory, with some more news yet to break. And... yeah, looking forward to getting the finals, finally getting the season sort of, or beginning that final descent towards it now. Don't forget, public entries go live on the 22nd of February. Check out EnduroWorldSeries.com for more on those. Rory, any pearls of wisdom you want to leave us with?
There was one thing, actually. Last week we talked about riders to watch. It might have been the week before. And I actually left the name out. Louis Jandal had, a 9th and a 10th. In the EWS rounds last year, Zermatt and Finale. I didn't know who he was. I kept seeing this rider riding, I think it was Sun, and I believe he's re-signed with them. I was very impressed, so shout out to him. And he's another one to watch for 2021.
You're like Colombo, aren't you? You just sort of came back in the door there with just one more question. God love you, you've been thinking about that for a week or so now, haven't you?
Yeah, fortnight, mate. It's been burning on my mind, but I'm glad I got off my chest.
Good work. I'm sure Louis will thank you whenever he sees you in person. Okay, everyone, thanks very much, and we'll see you next time.